It's a Tuesday episode of Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn. I'm here with Lisa Garvin, Layla Atassi, and Laura Johnston. And Layla and Laura, we've talked about how some of the women in your lives who are your age were marveling. They got shingles in their 40s, and the Washington Post now explains why. It's not really about stress. It's about the fact that you guys have inoculated your children for chickenpox, and so people who have had chickenpox are no longer exposed to it. Their defenses drop. They get shingles earlier in life. How about that?
Okay, I'm still going to say that I was stressed at the time that I got shingles during the pandemic when the kids were home half day and I was supposed to have foot surgery. So I feel like there was stress involved with the flare up. But you're right. And I have heard a lot of women say that they ended up with shingles. So that's really interesting because obviously I had chickenpox as a kid and my kids will never have to go through that.
But because you had chickenpox and the virus is in your system,
right,
your body's immune system would get recharged every time you were exposed to somebody with chickenpox, which normally would be your kids. I had chickenpox as a kid. My kids had chickenpox, so I got my immune system boosted. Didn't get shingles till I was in my 50s.
I was going to say, and then you got shingles later.
But that's the traditional. The defenses go down. The article in the Washington Post did say that this will go away, that your kids, because they never got the virus, won't get shingles because it's
right,
not in
your
system.
Right, because it's not dormant. Yeah.
So you're like in that middle generation that just gets it in both directions. You got chickenpox, you're getting shingles young. Anyway, fascinating story. We'd wondered what was happening. Now we have the answer. Let's get started. The Ohio legislature passed a bill to allow a lot more townships in Ohio to patrol interstate highways for speeders. Is this going to create a bunch of new speed traps that boost the township budgets? Layla, I was very suspicious of this law when it was proposed, but it's actually not that bad.
Yeah, interesting story here by Kaylee Remington and Olivia Mitchell. So this bill would give township police officers who serve populations between 5,000 to 50,000 residents the authority to enforce traffic offenses on interstates within their community's boundaries if the trustees approve it. But the legislation calls for all of those fines to go to county coffers for repairs on roads and bridges rather than to the townships themselves. The bill then is designed to deter townships from setting up these money-making speed traps. The backers of this bill say this is purely about public safety on the roads. And the bill would affect 40 of the 1,300 or so townships in the state, some of which are in Northeast Ohio. Most of those support the bill. And some of the townships like Madison Township and Montville are saying no thanks to this. Officials there said their officers are already stretched really thin and are responsible for the safety and well-being of thousands of residents whose tax dollars pay for their services. So why would they set up shop on the highway median and then run radar on drivers to try to catch speeders all day and squander those resources in the community when they should be put to use protecting their own people? So interesting. I mean, what's your take on this? Do you think that we're going to be seeing more of these local officers out on the highway controlling speed?
No,
I don't think so either.
No,
I think this is sort of pointless to even go down this road.
Right. Right. The only look, you go to Willoughby Hills and you go out west to some of the suburbs of west. They patrol the interstates because they rake in huge amounts of money for their budgets. And it's sleazy and it's predatory. Although Lisa's going to say, don't speed and you don't get the ticket. I get it. But the township police departments are tiny and they're generally there to patrol the neighborhoods and keep the peace. And let's face it, pulling people over has a danger quotient to it because you never know what you're walking up on, especially now that people don't have to tell you they have guns in the car. So I think for safety reasons and for efficiency, they're not going to. I don't know why they passed it in the end. It's like, what's the point? If township police are sitting out on interstates, I would think the residents of the township would say, come on, come protect my house.
Yeah.
Well, it started because of a lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court that a township police officer had pulled someone over on an interstate, and they said, you can't do that. You don't have the right. You're not highway patrol. So it took, like, I think a decade to pass this, but you're right. I can't see Bath Township, where I grew up, deciding they're going to send all their officers to go sit on 77 just to make it safer for all the commuters.
Now, if a township police officer happens to be using the interstate to get from point A to point B and see somebody driving ridiculously recklessly, then fine, they can pull them over and stop it. But I just don't. I was really worried this was going to create speed traps and get people into a lot more trouble. Lisa, come on, you whenever I bring up speed traps, you disagree and say we got to make the road slower and safer.
Well, the average ticket written on Mayfield Heights on that section of I-271 is in excess of 80 miles an hour, and they've had them as high as 110 miles an hour on that stretch of freeway. So, yeah.
Wow.
I wonder how high it goes on the turnpike, because people drive really fast.
How do you know that, Lisa?
From Cleveland.com and the Plain Dealer reporting. That's how I
but
know
did,
it.
We didn't include that in this story, did we? I feel like
no,
I feel like
no,
Lisa,
but,
like
but,
you, this is a real dear to your heart cause.
Well, don't forget, I was also for red light cameras in Houston, which was a huge controversy, and they ended up getting rid of them. But you know, yeah.
Yeah, actually, Lisa, you've kind of changed my mind on that. I do think that takes all the discrimination out of it, and there's probably a good reason to do it. I do notice, though, Laura, you're right. On the turnpike, the average speed is 80 miles an hour. If you're not going 80 miles an hour, everybody's passing.
That's because
you.
The speed limit is 70. And, like, my kids know going 9 over is just fine. Like,
yeah.
Like, Mom, you're speeding. Nope. And I'm not going to get caught going 9 over.
So, Lisa, when you're on the turnpike, are you doing the speed limit or do you take advantage?
I do not use the turnpike, but I am a fast driver. I'm usually a left lane person, you know, because I'm typically passing people. I usually drive about 77 miles an hour if traffic permits.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
Wait, in Cuyahoga County, you drive
77?
Even though the speed limit's 60?
Yes,
65.
Ma'am.
It's
but
60
I'm going with the flow
in,
of traffic. I mean, it's not like, you know, I'm kind of going, you
see,
know.
See, I
going
set my cruise at 69 every time I'm driving in Cuyahoga County. When I hit Summit or Lorraine, I'm like, yes, I can go 5 miles faster.
Lisa, if you're doing 77 miles an hour, you don't believe in red light cameras.
Well, that's apples and oranges, but yeah.
I know.
This is a very illuminated conversation this morning.
It was fun.
You can learn a lot about people based on how they drive.
You're listening to Today in Ohio. Was the State Board of Education even more reckless than previously thought with the selection of a state superintendent? Laura, I didn't think this story could get any more bizarre, but wow, Laura Hancock is a journalism hero on this one.
She really is. Hats off to Laura Hancock. She did all of the work on this story from the beginning. And the Ohio Department of Education and the school board, they knew there would likely be an Ohio Ethics Commission investigation. They did it anyway. They appointed Steve Dakin. And we know this thanks to Laura's reporting. And the fact is, they wanted to know everything she had requested. The Ethics Commission wanted to know everything she had requested from the Board of Education because they wanted to know what was going on. And the board voted for him 8 days after they got this letter from James E. Hood, the Deputy Director and General Counsel of the Ethics Commission. He wrote to the Interim Superintendent of Public Instruction asking her to bring this matter to the whole board. And then they just said, that's okay, we're going to vote for him anyway.
I loved that their letter said, we want everything you gave to Laura Hancock. It's like, we don't need to do an investigation. Just give us
all the work. She already did it.
Yeah, she did all the work. Just give us everything she got. And we're letting you know now, we're going to be doing an investigation. Let your board know. And then the board appoints them anyway. It's like, they've got one job, right? They appoint the state superintendent. This is the biggest thing. It's the most important thing they're doing this year. And they could not have screwed it up worse.
Yeah, 14 out of 19 board members voted for him. So you want to know who the five are that were like, yeah, not a good idea. But yeah, he resigned 11 days into his actual tenure. He opted not to take any of his $215,000 salary. And a public official at the Ethics Commission said that an investigation doesn't necessarily end just because he quit, but it might be mitigation that would impact the potential consequence for violating the law. So you have to think that Dakin was like, I'm resigning, I'm not taking my salary, so please don't charge me.
No, my bet is that even if they charge him, it'll be a very lightweight thing, because ultimately he did the right thing, even though the school board didn't. Actually,
well, after he did a lot of wrong things.
Yeah, but ultimately did the right thing. I actually think they should investigate the school board, because they appointed him in spite of being told, we're coming after you on this, this is wrong, which was so obvious to everybody who discussed this before they did it. The fact that they knew days before that this was a problem, and the fact that they requested all the records that Laura requested, you would have thought they would have had an executive session and say, okay, we can't do this, we need another finalist. This is completely broken. And let's remember, Mike DeWine has appointed most of these people, so this falls to Mike DeWine as well. He's appointing people that are making terrible and illegal decisions.
I do want to point out that Dakin had written to the Ethics Commission before this all happened. He was still board vice president. He asked about the proper way to handle the application, but he didn't fully disclose his role in leading the superintendent search. So maybe he thought, you know, if I just tell him just enough, then that'll cover my basis, and then they can't tell me I can't do it. I don't know what the point is if you're not going to be completely forthcoming.
He wasn't counting on Laura Hancock to do the reporting. That's what happened there. He thought, oh, I'll skate, and then Laura Hancock comes in and does great work. Way to go, Laura. It's Today in Ohio. How did Ohio Governor Mike DeWine respond to questions yesterday about how the bill he signed, making it easier to arm teachers, meshes with all those common sense gun laws he previously pushed for following the Dayton massacre? Lisa, what did he say?
Well, he kind of whiffed on those questions from reporters, but we'll get to that. We'll build up to that. So yesterday, House Bill 99 was signed by the governor in a press conference. And of course, this bill allows Ohio teachers to be armed with 24 hours of training. And that also establishes a mobile training team to train teachers. And there are annual retraining requirements for teachers who do choose to carry at school. DeWine, in the press conference after signing, said he would prefer that schools use law enforcement officers or trained security guards instead of arming teachers. But he said that schools will be mindful about who they designate and who will be bearing arms. His Democratic challenger, Nan Whaley, also held a press conference yesterday. She said that DeWine capitulated to extremists in the party. And she pointed out that teachers need 180 hours of certification to teach kids, but only 24 hours for firearms training. And she said, quote, that is insane. So as you remember, Nan Whaley was mayor of Dayton when, it's Dayton, right? Am I getting that right? Yeah.
Yep.
When there was that mass shooting in 2019. And after that, she said, do something, you know, to state leaders. Well, the bill sponsor, Representative Thomas Hall, said, today Ohio is doing something. So a reporter asked, well, do you think this is what Nan Whaley had in mind when she said do something? And the governor replied, I don't know. My job is to try to do things.
Well, before the primary, I understood Mike DeWine doing things that didn't really fit the character of what he'd said when he took office because he was being attacked from the right. But he's the Republican in the race. He's got it. He's not being attacked from the right. Unless that one guy gets in that looks unlikely. So he's running against Nan Whaley, like you said, the former mayor of Dayton, where there was a massacre, who's talking big on guns. He could have vetoed this. He could have said, no, this is not the way to protect schools. We're not going to add duties to teachers. I'm going to take a stand here. I put forth a bunch of common sense gun laws and red flag ideas. We need to get back to that. I'm not going to be part of this silly, fake response to the issues of the recent massacres. But he didn't, and he just blew off the reporters that asked, how does this coincide with what you've said previously?
Yeah, and like you said, that's a good point, Chris, is that, yeah, I mean, he's got a lock on the Republican nomination, so, yeah, he could literally do almost whatever he wants. I mean, I don't think he's going to lose that many Republican voters to Whaley, you know, over common sense gun laws.
Yeah, it's a disappointment because after he came through with those common sense gun laws, he visited us to talk about those. I mean, it was something very passionate, and we liked it because it was common sense stuff, keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. But since then, you know, he signed Stand Your Ground, which is resulting in a whole lot of people not getting charged with shootings. He has signed the permitless concealed carry. Now he signed the arming the teachers. And it's just, I love John Husted coming out to say, to really differentiate between the rural schools and the urban schools. He actually said this is for the schools in the rural areas down our way where they might be more comfortable with this. Like saying, yeah, of course, we don't want these guns in the schools in the urban districts, but this is for the rural districts. Wouldn't it be nice if all of the gun laws made a difference between urban and rural? You know, if they allowed the cities to do what they want to do while allowing the rural folks to have the different approach. But no, it's not.
Yeah, and let us point out, especially in Ohio, that rural areas are pretty white. So in urban right. areas, not so much. So,
All right, you're listening to Today in Ohio. The Cleveland region ranked first in the nation in April in a category nobody wants the lead in, especially in this economy. Layla, what was it?
Well, unfortunately, it's the unemployment rate. Greater Cleveland's unemployment rate of 5.4% in April was the highest of any metro area with a population of 1 million or more, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And that's out of 51 metro areas with a population that size. To put this in perspective, reporter Zach Smith tells us that the Minneapolis-St. Paul-Bloomington metro area in Minnesota and Wisconsin had the lowest unemployment rate at 1.5%. And Columbus seems to be just doing way better than we are. The Columbus metro area ranks 24th with an unemployment rate of 2.9%. That's 2.2 percentage points lower than April of last year. Cincinnati ranked 42nd at 3%. A 1.6 percentage point difference from the prior year. So it's pretty bleak for Cleveland, for the greater Cleveland area.
Yeah, we should point out that's still a fairly low rate compared to the worst of times. It's just odd that with all that is going on in Northeast Ohio, that we'd be the worst in the nation. I just would have thought that there'd be other areas that are more affected by something we'll be talking about in a while, supply chain problems and things like that, that would be higher than us. And I'm really kind of confounded.
And it's also interesting because there's so many jobs, right? There's so many jobs. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about that. And you know, in combining that information with what we've learned about the great resignation in Ohio, and, you know, after reading the story, I went back and looked at Sean McDonald's story in May about that study called, you know, Where Are the Workers, which surveyed right. nearly, you know, the 5,000 working age adults across 11 counties in Northeast Ohio. And it said that, you know, I cued in on the sentence that said, of all the people surveyed who are not employed, which excludes retirees, 54% were not looking for work. But only 7.4% of those said that they were not choosing to work. Others were stay-at-home parents, had disabilities that prevented them from working, or had health issues. So it really seems that the vexing problem here is the lack of support for people who desperately need to rejoin the workforce. You know, the Great Resignation certainly isn't just about, you know, privileged middle-class employees deciding they're going to quit their job to, you know, whatever, sell homemade potholders on Etsy or whatever. I think this story today reflects the unemployed masses who lack the support, perhaps specifically reliable childcare to return to the workforce, despite, you know, this completely saturated job market that we see.
I wonder if it's also that the jobs that are open require qualifications that people just don't have. I mean, Layla, you're exposed to people in the healthcare industry. Do you get the feeling there are a lot of unfilled jobs right now?
Oh, 100%. There is such a shortage of nurses. Yes, my husband is in that field, and they are really struggling to fill the ranks.
And if you don't have the training, you can't fill those jobs. And I imagine that because that is our number one industry by
that is true
shot,
but just look at the help wanted signs in every sector. I mean, from the low skill to, I mean, look everywhere you go, fast food, the fast food industry is hurting as much as any other. You know, they close their doors early because they can't staff up to the end of the night. It's everywhere. And I actually do think it boils down to these unmet needs in society. You know, I've met many parents who are like, how am I going to find childcare for my children? And they expect me to go to work. How am I going to do this? So,
but, you know, I have to wonder about the greater Cleveland age demographics here. You know, I don't know if they've compared that to the other cities in this report, but, you know, we have a pretty gray population in Northeast Ohio, and I just wonder if that's a factor.
It could be. We you're right. We do have an elderly population. Just kind
and
of.
I think it's interesting though that this is just the five counties because Akron Canton is a different metro area, so they didn't rank as high.
Hmm. Yeah, just a surprising headline. You didn't expect to see it. You're listening to Today in Ohio. More bad news for the economy. How much have rents in Cleveland gone up in the past year, and how does that compare to inflation? Laura, we've been hearing anecdotally from people we work with that rents have been staggering in compared to what they were even 3-4 years ago. What do we know?
Yeah, I mean, the median prices for rent have increased by 19.3% in the seven counties that make up Greater Cleveland. This is just since May of 2021, so a year ago. Now the average cost of rent is about $1,100 a month, and that's double the rate of inflation that we're seeing these apartments go up. Two zip codes have seen more than 100% increase in that year. That's Fairview Park, which is 123% increase, and Mayfield, 111%. This is not a scientific sample. This is from Rent Hub. They aggregate the rents advertised for new tenants from online listings for apartments, rental houses, and multi-unit homes. Obviously, not everything is advertised online. It's only a sample of the area. Doesn't reflect what existing renters are paying, just the new folks. But here's a surprise. The Brattonall zip code had a decrease in this time period, making it the cheapest rent in seven counties. I would not have thought that Brattonall.
How many rental units are in Brattonall?
Well, maybe there's like only
like that. Come on.
If there were too few, Rent Hub didn't count them. So there have to be some apartments. But yeah, that struck me as bizarre. One of the most expensive places are Beechwood, the downtown core stretching to Playhouse Square, and North Olmsted. And one of the reasons they give when you think about it is you're like, why is rent going up so much? Obviously, look at the prices of houses. Those are also going up. But there are more households than there were at the beginning of the pandemic, people who are living together. I think during the pandemic, they might have sheltered together, but then they now separated. And so people don't need roommates as much. And people are making more in this economy, which is kind of going against the last story we talked about. So they can afford these rents. And I guess, you know, it's supply and demand.
Okay. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We've all been hammered by the chronic supply chain shortages affecting pretty much the entire planet. So how is Cleveland going to be at the center of a discussion by major players on how to cope with the shortages? Lisa, this is cool that we're going to be the center of attention on this.
Yeah, absolutely. The National Retail Federation is meeting June 20th and 21st at the Huntington Convention Center. They're inaugurating a new conference. It's called Supply Chain 360. There will be attendees from major retail chains, product suppliers, and shippers. And it's basically just a roll up your sleeves, you know, let's discuss how we can make the supply chain more resilient. Big players, American Eagle, Walmart, Kroger, Best Buy, and then we'll have some local input from the CEO of the Cleveland Port Authority, Will Friedman, and also from the Urban League's Goran Dillard. So basically, they want to figure out how they can fix this. They know that supply chain issues are not going to go away. The National Retail Federation Vice President of Supply Chains, John Gold, says the issue is big enough for a separate conference. They're going to focus on operations, information technology, and sustainability as ways to kind of ease the knots in the supply chain. He says the problem is there's never been a lot of redundancy in supply chains. So they have to figure out things. Can they reshore certain things? Can they diversify where they buy their products from? They want to talk about the future of electric vehicles and delivering products. They also want to digitize supply chains, you know, to that also helps with the environment as well. So, yeah, interesting that this big global conversation is taking place in Cleveland.
And it's retailers that are involved, and they're the ones that are getting hammered because they don't have the stuff people want to buy. It's great they're having the conversation. I can't wait to see what they come up with because this seems like a very difficult challenge. If you can't get the raw materials, you can't get the pieces, what do you do? I mean, there's severe barriers. And maybe the onshoring you mentioned will be something that they they look to more. So we'll have to pay close attention to that when they're in town. You're listening to Today in Ohio. What is the new Pulse platform at University Hospitals, and how will it prevent some challenging surgeries from going wrong? Layla? Our resident medical expert, we turn to you.
So the Pulse platform creates 3D images of a patient's spine, which really increases the chances of a successful surgery. UH's Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital was among the first in the world to use Pulse to perform pediatric spine surgery this month. Doctors used it to perform surgery on a 12-year-old girl from Northeast Ohio with adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. That's curvature of the spine. Doctors love this technology because it exposes the pediatric patient to less radiation than traditional imaging. And it pulls together all the technology used in pediatric spine surgery in one place. So it combines X-ray imaging and image enhancement from 2D to 3D and alignment tools to correctly straighten the spine. And it monitors the spinal cord as it is stretched or curved during surgery, which helps prevent injury that can lead to paralysis. So super cool. And what an awesome advancement.
It's very cool. And you hope you never have to experience
it. Yes, yes.
Because that sounds like tough stuff. All right. Always good to have a medical innovation that's being used in our healthcare industry. It's Today in Ohio. Pandemic was hard on Cleveland coffee shops and roasters, but do we have some evidence that business is coming back? You know, we talked earlier about how Starbucks had largely vacated downtown except for a couple of locations, and coffee shops were not being visited as much during the pandemic. Is it all turned around? What do you know, Laura?
It is. I believe that we are seeing more people return to the coffee shops, and it's not just for coffee. The idea is they want to be a welcoming place. So this is this new cafe called Etta in Ohio City. It's across from the West Side Market in the Intro Cleveland building, this is that massive timber-built apartment building. It's the biggest in the world right now, I believe. And it's going to have this very Norse, Nordic feel, and the name is after Norse mythological poetry. So that'll be open soon.
We also had we have a story coming, right, that two more Starbucks are going to...
It did publish late last night, yeah. So two more Starbucks are getting the chance to vote on whether they want a union or not. So that vote hasn't taken place, but that'll be on Clifton Boulevard in Cleveland near the Lakewood border, and in Mayfield Road in Cleveland Heights. They're separate mail-in elections, so it could be one store decides to go and the other doesn't. And those voting will start June 21st.
Yeah, it's been interesting. We have two already, and this would be two more. Starbucks really coming under that union representation.
Yeah, 162 have voted. Of those, 100, like this is across the country, and 133 were in favor of a union. A couple of are still being challenged. So, yeah, it's definitely a change in Starbucks.
All right. It's Today in Ohio. That'll do it. We do have monkeypox in Ohio, we found out yesterday. One guy somewhere in the state, the health department's not saying, has
it. All they say is it's an adult male.
Yeah, very, very helpful. But it's not like coronavirus. You do have to have direct skin contact.
Yeah,
to
with a scab, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not like this is ready to rage. It would be nice to know maybe which county it's in, but they always rely on HIPAA, which does not protect this.
Yeah, they don't even want to say if that person traveled somewhere where there's a monkeypox hotspot, because they don't want kind of any identifying information. Yeah. So they're just, you know, they're just watching. So let us know.
Very helpful. All right. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Layla. Thank you, Laura. Thanks to everybody who listens to this podcast. We'll be back Wednesday to be talking about some more news.